So we were talking before about this Interfaith Climate March, and you talk to people that are working on climate and combating climate change, and there's a tremendous amount of grief. And most of the people that are working on that are motivated by really what's at stake, you know, what's potentially lost. We had a little thing that I've seen two or three times that we did at our march where we had people sign a ribbon of what it is that, you know, you might lose if climate change is not addressed. And it's very touching to read those and hear about the, you know, the birds and the tropical coral reefs and so forth. That grief can be disabling. It can turn to despair. And when we move through it, it can be enabling. It can be motivating. When we're willing to be with it. Jenny, who worked with me on the Climate March, is the one that sent me that poem that I read at the end of the sitting. That was The Well of Grief by David White. And he also sent me this wonderful article from Francis Weller, who's a psychotherapist over in Sonoma County. And Francis Weller says, one of the most important things we can do right now in this culture is to grieve, because it is a protest against this collective agreement to turn our backs on what is happening. Okay. So we have these things that are happening at the societal level. We live in this grief-denying culture, and there are these things that are going on at the societal level that seem so obvious to some of us and are being denied at the same time by others. So really a challenge there. And then on the personal level, here we are. We have come to some sort of mindfulness practice, some sort of intention to look at what is happening in our lives and just be with it. To actually look, well, how am I living my life? Am I living a life that's consistent with my deepest values? Am I living a life that has some level of even knowing what's going on in my life, or am I just sort of floating along on automatic pilot? So we've taken on this practice, and just by being here, you're expressing a willingness to, you know, take on the whole catastrophe, as Jon Kabat-Zinn, or Zorba the Greek calls it, but Jon Kabat-Zinn adapted it to his exploration of facing sickness, right, with the mindfulness-based stress reduction, facing chronic illness, chronic pain, and all of that, and just really facing it, really being with it. So in this practice, we come to this Buddhist practice with a willingness to look at what's happening in my body and mind at any given moment. This is beautifully illustrated in a poem by Mary Oliver called Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. And then she gives a beautiful description of the world going on that we'll get to later. So this step of telling others about our despair is really valuable. The grief of the destruction that's ahead of us if climate change isn't addressed is way too big for any one of us to take on as an individual. And the realizations that we come to in this practice about unskillful thought patterns and speech patterns and behavior patterns that we've engaged in our lives are really hard to hold as an individual too. That's why one of the three jewels is community, Sangha, because it takes a certain kind of spaciousness to be able to hold the realizations as we move through this practice and bring up difficult material in our own lives. It takes a certain kind of spaciousness to even be with that, that is difficult to create as an individual, you know. And yet in community, we can create the ability to be with difficult emotions as we've been talking about throughout this series, and just be with the sometimes cruel and sometimes laughable crazy habits of our own mind and heart. So I thought we would pause here and just take a moment to share with each other. So what we're going to do is we're going to break into dyads. And if you hate dyads, well, then look at that. That'll be your practice. I just thought this one would work better just in twos. And what I would like you to do, and I'll ring the bell as we go back and forth, is to find another person, and actually it could be someone that you already know, because this isn't the kind of stuff we talk about all that often with each other. So I want you to pair up with somebody, and I want you to start by one person telling the other person, I'll give you a minute or two, depending on the energy in the room. I want you to start by one person telling the other person a societal grief that they're holding, something at the the level of this state or this country, this world, or your school district, or you know, whatever it might be, some larger societal grief that you're holding right now, and just say what it is and what it is that that moves you about that. You know, no need to apologize for it, no need to try to explain it, but just say what it is and then what it is about that moves you, and then I'll ring it again and we'll share the other way. So listeners, that's your job, mindful listening. Notice the reaction in your body as this other person is speaking. So much of this, you know, as you heard in the Mary Oliver poem, is about the body and what's, you know, where we hold that grief. I mean, it's a real palpably felt in the body. And so that's part of being with grief, is actually learning to sense it in the body. So please pair up. I'll ring the bell in a minute or two and share what kind of larger grief is sort of moving in your life right now. Thanks to all of you for your willingness to share that. It's not something we have a lot of practice at, but definitely worth diving in and being willing to open up. The willingness to move through grief opens up space in our lives for other things like gratitude and joy. Francis Weller again was talking to a woman in Burkina Faso in West Africa. And he said, "You have so much joy." And she replied, "That's because I cry a lot." So, you know, in this practice, we often talk about the fact that we aren't, you know, we gradually develop the ability not to just be flying off the handle to every little trigger that comes along. We develop an ability to not be so reactive to things. And so people mistake that, or mistake the Brahmavihara, the positive quality of equanimity, to be this sort of flat-lined lack of any kind of emotion, right? And so it's really important to remember that what this practice is really about is fully embracing life in all of its ups and downs. The ability to be with, you know, the positive, to be with the unpleasant, to be with all of that and still maintain our center. So, you know, just a reminder that this moving through grief is really a necessary step to develop the ability to feel joy. You know, there's a mythologist. Actually, took my dad to see him once in San Francisco. That was another story. Michael Mead, who did a lot of the mythopoetic men's group stuff in the early 90s. And he says that there's three layers of experience. And this first one we know really well. Hey, how's it going? Fine, how about you? Right? So we all know that one really well. The third layer is deep soul contact and true intimacy. And the second layer is difficult emotions, such as grief, anger, rage, envy, and violence. And the trick is that to get from that first layer to the third one, you have to go through the second. Yeah. Sorry. You have to go through the second one. You have to go through the ability to feel before you can be vulnerable and intimate with others. You know, that shutting down of the heart doesn't just shut down the unpleasant. It shuts it all down. It shuts down the ability to see what's happening around us, you know, the suffering in others. It shuts down the ability to appreciate a compliment when someone gives it to us. And it, you know, I mean, it shuts down the pain of the evening news, which is great, you know, but that pain is real. So in this practice, you know, starting with the ability to be with an unpleasant sensation in our knee during a sitting, you know, we bring that into our daily life and we gradually develop the ability to engage in a conversation with a homeless person on the street, even though that might not be all that pleasant. So it's a gradual training in being more and more with whatever is happening in the moment. That's what insight is. It's what Vipassana is the willingness, first of all, the intention would be the formal Buddhist word, but the willingness to be with the unpleasant. And from that develops an openness and a vulnerability and the ability to be with all experience. Okay. Grief is not an abstraction. This is Francis Weller again. This article is in Sun magazine, by the way, the October issue. Grief is not an abstraction. You can't think your way through it. You have to have a physical encounter with it. It's a bodily experience. You need to feel the tightness in the chest or belly before we can engage with it meaningfully. Okay, so I think those of you that have done this practice, you know what he's talking about there. You know, that ability to say, oh, yeah, well, where does that hit me? You know, when I hear this other person talking about their personal grief, you know, where do I feel that in the body? Is that something, you know, is that a little sort of a quivering back here? You know, back in the back of the throat, that's maybe related to crying or sobbing, you know, some little subtle version of that. Is it a tightness in the chest as we close down because the grief is just too great for us to handle in this moment? What is it? Where is that lodge in the body? And just to know, I think most of you probably do know if you've been practicing for a while, that when these things lodge in the body and are not attended to, they stay there, right? They form these knots. Dennis, Diane and I were talking about the talk tonight, and Dennis was recommending a book by Stephen Levine called Unattended Sorrow. And the subtitle of it is Recovering from Loss and Reviving the Heart. Okay. So unattended sorrow is what we're talking about here. Is if we are not willing to be with grief, okay, we're not going to be able to recover from it, first of all. And second of all, you know, the heart's going to wither. It's going to lose its capacity to be open and to respond. The work of the mature person is to carry grief in one hand and gratitude in the other, and be stretched large by them. How much sorrow can I hold? That's how much gratitude I can give. If I only carry grief, I'll bend towards cynicism and despair. If I only have gratitude, I'll become saccharine and won't develop much compassion for other people's suffering. Okay. So that's that balance that we talk about quite a bit in this practice, about the balance between the wisdom and the compassion, and the wisdom being dry without the qualities of the heart, and the qualities of the heart being ungrounded without the wisdom. So he's really saying the same thing in a slightly different way here. We have to be in correct relationship with sorrow. If we drown in it, nothing happens. If we get too detached, nothing happens. We need the right amount of attention and separation to turn our grief into something vital and life-serving. So in terms of practice, I think we all know what he means by separation, right? He doesn't mean this detachment, this pushing away, this walling off of the heart. What he's talking about there is just mindfulness. Mindful attention, actually being aware that we're aware of our grief. Just that much separation. We're close with it, we're intimate, we're touching it, just as the attention touches the sound of the train going by, or the sensation of the discomfort in the knee, the mind touches it, but we're not absorbed in it, right? We're not identified with it. We're not getting lost in the experience. We have just enough spaciousness, let's call it, to be able to know that we're aware of that experience and to really be with that experience without judging it, trying to change it or push it away. Does that all make sense from your practice? Okay. So really, he is encouraging us to use the body, as we do so often in this practice, to sense the depth of our grief, to work through it, which just means to be with it, let it develop. You know, I think we've all heard the stages of grief, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and so forth. They don't follow a timeline, right? They don't come in any particular order. They just work us. And just to be willing to know that grief is not on a timeline. You know, I mean, I remember when my dad died, we just sat around for a week. And, I mean, none of us, the whole week, had any concept of time. My uncle came down, he's actually older, my dad came down from Reno, telling stories and just sitting around and, you know, people dropping by. And I think back on it and there's a certain clarity to it, but there's no linearity to it at all. It just comes and goes, and, you know, when the grief hits you, you're never prepared for when that's going to happen. You think you are. You know, Weller talks about being on this retreat and, you know, not being really in touch with his grief, and then someone put his hand on his shoulder and he broke down and he cried for days. You know, when Mary and I had to place our younger daughter in a group home, you know, she was diagnosed as autistic and she was super hyperactive, and it was just really, really hard on the family. So when we placed her in the group home, it was over in Hollister. So we put her in, we were living in Visalia at the time, drive across the valley, took her over there, dropped her off, drove all the way back. We didn't talk much on the way back, but, you know, I hadn't really broken down yet. And got back home, kind of doing this and that, and kind of making myself busy, right? It's really good defense. And I went into her room, and her little blanket was on the ground. I picked it up, and I smelled it. Oh, my God, you know, just boom. I mean, I was sobbing for a long time. So isn't the body wonderful? You know, I mean, we have all these senses, and they are there to serve us. You know, that sense of smell can just cut through. I mean, like, if I just say to you, you know, what's the smell of rosemary? You know, that's the herb of remembrance for a reason, right? I mean, once you smell that, you know what it smells like. You know, and just smelling that smell just cut through all of the pretense and all of the competence and all of the coping, and just went right to the heart, right? So you know, the willingness to open up the senses to the truth of what's below we're even willing to face is, that's a cause for gratitude right there. In fact, my retreat, my day long at the end of this month is going to be, right now the working title is Gratitude and Forgiveness, but after doing all this research, I'm thinking of calling Gratitude, Grief, and Forgiveness, right? Move through that second layer before we can get to the others. And of course, forgiveness is a way we do that. I mean, forgiveness in itself is a willingness to face you know, the difficult things that we faced either within ourselves or from others, and then move through them. Not to say they're okay, but to actually move through them. So we'll be doing that work on the last Saturday of this month, right after Thanksgiving. Finish with a bedtime story, but first let's hear Mary Oliver move. Let's let her tell us about the world going on. And really, that's the beauty of bringing an awareness to the despair of what could happen with climate change is, you know, in addition to being moved by grief, many of us are also moved by absolute love of the natural world. And, you know, Mary Oliver is a practitioner and has many wonderful poems about being out in nature, but because of this connection here with despair, I really love the way that she does the full circle here. So we'll read the whole thing now. Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. So one way of connecting with others in the world of grief is by coming to an understanding that at some level none of this is personal. It's a universal human experience. Both the loss and the grief are universal human experiences. And there's a beautiful story in the Buddhist tradition about that. It's actually not in any of the suttas. It's in the commentaries. And sometimes we kind of put down the commentaries because, you know, well, they were written later and they were maybe or maybe not Buddhist practitioners and so forth. But because this story is so prominent in our culture and it is a Buddhist story, I really wanted to share it tonight. And I just love the message. So it's the story of Gotami, Kisa Gotami and the mustard seed. And it's funny because the story of Kisa Gotami that is in the canon is another really tragic, multiple tragic events that happened to her, and then she, kind of similar to this, goes crazy and then is eventually brought to sanity by the Buddha. And this particular translation, I think I'll actually read it because Andrew Olensky, who's a scholar from the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, has done a new translation of it, and it's really lovely, and it's kind of a different take on it. So I'll read a lot of this. It's a bit long, but it's worth listening to. After flowing on for 100,000 ages, she, Kisa Gotami, evolved in this Buddha era among gods and men in a poor family in Savatthi. Her name was Gotami Tissa, but because her body was very skinny, she was called Skinny Gotami. When she went to her husband's family, she was scorned and called daughter of a poor family. Then she gave birth to a son, and with the arrival of the son, she was treated with respect. But that son, running back and forth and running all around while playing, met his end. Because of this, sorrow to the point of madness arose in her. Sorrow to the point of madness arose in her. She thought, before I was the one who received only scorn, but starting from the time of the birth of my son, I gained honor. These relatives will now try to take my son in order to expose him outside. In other words, to put him in the charnel ground, right? Under the influence of her sorrow to the point of madness, she took the dead corpse on her hip and wandered in the city from the door of one house to another, pleading, "Give medicine to me for my son." People reviled her, saying, "What good is medicine?" She did not grasp what they were saying. And then a certain wise man, thinking, "This woman has had her mind deranged by sorrow for her son." The ten-powered, which is one of the names for the Buddha, will know the medicine for her, said, "Mother, having approached the fully awakened one, ask about medicine for your son." She went to the vihara at the time of the teaching of Dhamma and said, Blessed one, give me medicine for my son." The master, seeing her situation, said, "Go, having entered the city, into whatever house has never before experienced any death, and take from them a mustard seed." So, you know, the mustard seed, a little tiny round thing about this big, and it's the commentaries on this say it's probably the least expensive Indian spice at that time. "Very well, sir," she replied, "and glad of mind. She entered the city and came to the first house. "The master has called for a mustard seed in order to make medicine for my son. If this house has never before experienced any death, give me a mustard seed." "Who is able to count how many have died here?" "Then keep it. What use is that mustard seed to me?" And going to a second and a third house, her madness left her, and her right mind was established, thanks to the power of the Buddha. She thought, "This is the way it will be in the entire city. By means of the Blessed One's compassion for my welfare, this will be what is seen." And having gained a sense of spiritual urgency from that, she went out and covered her son in the charnel ground. She uttered this verse. "It's not just a truth for one village or town, nor is it a truth for a single family, but for every world settled by gods and men. And this indeed is what is true, impermanence." And so saying, she went into the presence of the master. Then the master said to her, "Have you obtained, Gotami, the mustard seed?" "Finished, sir, is the matter of the mustard seed," she said. "You have indeed restored me." And the master then uttered this verse. "A person with a mind that clings, deranged, to sons or possessions, is swept away by death that comes like a mighty flood to a sleeping town." Had a few of those in the last few weeks, haven't we? flood like a mighty flood to a sleeping town. At the conclusion of this verse, confirmed in the fruit of stream entry, she asked the permission to go forth into the homeless life. The master allowed her to go forth. She gave homage to the master by bowing 3 times, went to join the community of nuns, and having gone forth, received her ordination. It was not long before, through the doing of deeds with careful attention, she caused her insight to grow, and she became an arahant. So she awakened in this life. Questions, comments?
I'm a little confused about touching, being aware of the grief, being mindful of it, and not being in it.
Yeah, because we've all known the experience of being in it, right?
Mm.
Yeah. I get, like anything else, it takes practice. And it, in my experience, it's, we're not going to get it right. There's no getting it right. There's just living it. So what I have found is that there are periods of, you know, going into it and being overwhelmed by it and being identified with it, and then coming out and being able to see it with some kind of clarity. When I was speaking earlier about the non-linearity and the non-time frame of all of this, it, to me, it's not like sitting on the cushion and following the breath, you know, and sometimes being in touch with and sometimes not. Mm-hmm. It is really a much larger cycle. The cycle of grief is a much larger cycle. And so, you know, I would say, in my experience, when I have been overwhelmed by grief, I can't in that moment say, oh, well, I'm just going to, you know, go back to my Buddhist practice and I'm going to, you know, find some separation here, separation in the healthy sense of, you know, enough spaciousness that I can actually see that I'm grieving. Mm-hmm. So what it's been for me is actually going into that and sinking into it and then coming back up and working with it after. You know, we talk about practicing before, during, and after. It's really practicing with it after. And it's like, oh, what was that? And where am I still feeling that in my body? You know, that's one way that I have found that I can touch it, is when I'm not in the complete depths of it and I'm sort of, you know, come up for air, so to speak, to be able to actually remember, well, where is that in the body? What did that feel like at the time? Because you're right. I mean, it's such a powerful state that it's very, very difficult in the moment to just have it turn off, you know? I mean, it's not like some of our other reactive habits where, you know, we're just sort of triggered by one particular thing and there's this kind of habitual emotional reaction to that, and we, you know, after a while we can get to know those, right? The thing I found out with grief is that every grieving is different, you know? So my dad died in 2003, my sister died in 2007, and she had a long thing with cancer and was remission and came back, and so we all pretty much knew that she was going to die. In fact, I remember Mary and I sitting on a couch with her at Christmas and just watching the rest of the family. It was like 30 people in our family, you know, sort of interacting and laughing. And we were all just kind of sitting there watching that. And three of us all knew it was her last Christmas, right? And so watching that, and so I thought, oh, I'm prepared for this. You know, that delusion, it's unbelievable. But, you know, oh, yeah, well, I've been to my dad's death. Oh yeah, well, I've done some therapy around some other deaths in the family. Man, I'm prepared for this death. Are you kidding? I get the phone call at work that she died, and again drove all the way down to Marin where she was. She was still in her bed when I got there, and same thing with Celia. I got in on the bed with her, and just she's still warm, you know, and just. Seeing, you know, I mean, it's one thing to see her in your mind's eye, but actually to see the body, you know, the person actually was kind of still there in a way. Just totally broke down. So, no, I wasn't prepared. It was felt completely different, you know. So, I mean, to me, part of the power of this practice is knowing patterns. And so, you know, okay, what is it that gets me angry? What is it that gets me irritated? What is it that gets me mildly annoyed? What is, you know, eventually you learn those patterns, you can work with them. I haven't found that with grief. I've found that each one is so individual, each grieving is so individual that I kind of need to work with them one at a time as they happen. You know, I mean, the upside of it is that, you know, the grieving itself, generally you're not going to harm yourself or others. I mean, the grieving itself is not an unskillful behavior, right? Mm-hmm. Like lashing out in rage or being reactive to feeling disrespected or whatever, right? There, with those patterns, the tendency is going to be to have some kind of overly defensive speech or behavior or thoughts or something like that. With grieving, I mean, you know, unless we're prone to clinical depression or whatever. I mean, grief, if we don't let go of it, if we really identify with it and don't come back out, don't come back up for air once in a while, can develop into depression. But in general, the grieving process itself, you know, the mourning, the tears, the disorientation, is probably not going to harm yourself or others. So go into it. Allow it to express itself. It's in itself, it's not an unskillful behavior. You know, it's just a natural expression of human emotion.
Seems like that story you were telling about that lady who went mad with it. She had to let go of it at some point. Come back to her mind.
Right. Right, yeah. And the child is just a metaphor for whatever it is that we have to let go of, right, to be free. Mm-hmm. And the way she did that was in community, you know, by door-to-door realizing, hey, this isn't my grief. This is universal. This is a universal human experience.
I see when you're talking, it seems like in our culture it's not okay to become deranged or to become, like for me, I'm afraid to cry, I'm afraid to get emotional because I won't come back. Mm-hmm. And so the few times I have broken down, it's like the people that are with me, it's scary for them, they don't know how to, so people want to impose or they want to touch or they want to, you know, and that breaks the cycle. But for me, it seems like when people start to cry, it's like an apology, and it's like it's a shameful thing to And I'm going, wow, that's kind of a, you know, I was in a hospital once and I started feeling my body for the first time. And I started sobbing and I got a shot in the butt and put in a paper gown. And that was a true story. It was an abuse. And it's like, you know, but that's the way in our country we react. And that's deranged, and my actions were deranged, but like you were saying, I felt 100% pure. I felt 100% present, you know.
Right.
But to the outside person looking in, it's deranged, or you know, you're off your rocker, you're going to paper gown, and it's, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
I just think that when you're talking about the word deranged, it could be temporarily.
Right.
To
yeah,
the
I know.
Outside world.
I mean, what I was saying earlier about, you know, permission to even share our experiences with another person, no, it's not there. I mean, it takes a place of safety like this, or some of our small affinity groups or whatever, to be able to do that, because you just can't walk to a stranger on the bus and say, oh, yeah, you know, I'm really grieving the extinction of Hawaiian birds today. It's like, huh? You know, I'm saying that to somebody here and they know what I'm talking about. So, yeah, that's part of the challenge. But the whole practice is against the stream, right? I'm actually noticing what's going on. Who does that in this culture? It's a culture of distraction. It's a culture of acquisition. It's a culture of performance. It's a culture of achievement. You know, this whole practice is crazy from that point of view.
Don't show emotions. Don't feel your feelings. Don't
right.
Feel you're weak.
Right. Don't just do something. Sit there. You know? Yeah. So you're right. I mean, and awareness of that is valuable, right? Because we certainly don't want to make ourselves vulnerable in situations where we're liable to be, you know, unduly hurt. So it's like, oh, well, wow, now Buddha's practice has made me so insensitive. Now I can go out and, you know, totally open up to every stranger on the street. No, that's not it. I mean, it's developing, you know, some kind of awareness of self-care. You know, and part of that includes knowing when to hold them. And no, I'm not going to say. Thanks. Yeah, that's really important to keep in mind. Yeah, but
sort of along the same lines that Brian's talking about is when I was young, if you know a person I knew had a friend die or a loved one died, I would avoid them like the plague. And I think some people don't grow out of that, you know, in our culture. You know, turning the coin around, it's like most people that are grieving don't expect a person much from a person, other than just to say hi, you know, how are you doing, I'm sorry. I mean, you don't have, it doesn't have to be a profound diet of lecture or whatever.
Right.
And I've also had the experience of experiencing a person that was not able to separate from their grief. I was asked to be a pallbearer for the brother of her brother, who had died at a fairly young age. And in that family, there was the one young boy and three girls. And the mother never got over the death of that son, totally ignored the three girls growing up, giving them not such a good relationship with their mother. But to the day that she died, she was totally in grief about the death of the young boy.
Yeah. Thank you.
The first significant death for me was when my father died, and I was in my early 30s, and I remember reading a lot about grief at the time, and the studies that showed that if you have a fall apart at first, if you're able to fall apart at first, not recovery is, you have a better chance at a sort of a wholesome recovery in the long run than in our culture where you sort of stiff upper lip. And I learned the Jewish custom of Shiva just made so much sense, where the community comes around and let the family fall apart a little or have freedom to grieve in that way. And it came home to me, particularly when my mother died, because I was executor of her estate and I had so much business to take care of. So I'd been taking care of her for 12 years. My grief was profound, but I really needed to get that business done, and that's been harder to recover from.
Thank you.
I was thinking about a number of clients. You know, as a therapist, I found that a lot of people really don't have any idea how intense grief really feels, and they'll come in and really they'll be crying a lot, and they'll think they're somehow crazy or they're over the top. You know, they're not somehow functioning more or less normally. And yet, grief is really the most intense. It's probably the most difficult emotion we ever experience. And so many people either they think they have to cut it off because it's too frightening, or and as Brian was saying, a lot of people feel like they're going to never stop crying if they allow themselves to feel it. But also, our culture has such expectations that people won't keep grieving. And I was thinking of a client I have whose son died, and she went to a retreat of parents whose children have died. And she came back and said that most of those parents have a foreshortened life expectancy, that most of them don't live as long. I mean, you know, they seem to die younger. I think because, and you know, I mean, interpreting that and seeing her as well, it's just so hard for them to actually, everything in their life gets hard to relate to other people. They live in a different sort of world, you might say. And we've seen on TV people who have lost family members in violence, and they say, you know, this is a club you don't want to belong to because it's so separating. So, yeah, I don't know. I just think that grief is just so, and you know, I always tell people the only way out of grief is through it. Mm-hmm. No matter what else you do, you just have to allow yourself to feel it. And I appreciated what the other woman brought up, because I was thinking when you said, you can grieve and you're not really, you know, you're not really, you kind of don't identify with it. But I think it's impossible not to identify with it when it's that intense, when you're really in acute grief. And to try to separate yourself is just a defense. It's just a way not to feel what you feel. But I think you're right. Grief comes in waves. I know you're right. And so you can kind of go up and down with that.
It's an interesting discussion. I was thinking back on my experience when I was younger and when my friends died when I was still a teenager. And I remember the experience of the grief was so intense and so searing. It really kind of terrified me. And so it's almost like I sort of like pulled down the window shades and closed the door on that, and in part because it was terrifying, and in part because there was this great social conformity to soldier on, Gunga Din, and certainly a male thing, you know, that you're supposed to do, particularly if you're a young athlete. And then it reminded me, this was sort of flashing on this thing, I was talking to a friend of mine back when I was an undergrad in Berkeley, and a friend of mine was frying on acid, and we were talking, and he was playing cello, and he was kind of having a hard time with his trip, and I was kind of trying to help him and keep him stay calm. And he said, the thing about acid is sometimes it rips doors open in your head that were meant to stay closed. It was sort of an odd comment. And whatever the case. So what I find is, looking back on this now as an old guy who's starting to press up against 60, I think it's sort of like, this is like a two-story or three-story house, and I've been living in one story of it for decades. There's like these other floors down there that like I never opened the door to.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, the mythopoetic people talk about doing the ashes work, you know, going down or going into the underworld. You know, that kind of metaphor, like you're saying, of going down into the lower floors of the house. and being willing to be there for a while. You know, it's important work. It's important depth work.
Hey, Rich?
Yeah.
Would we be remiss in not mentioning Sim's recovery sangha that helps deal with all this unwinding notes?
Why don't you mention that, Brian?
It's a beautiful sangha that meets on Monday nights. If anybody else has escapeaholic in tendencies, so.
Meets right here or there, depending on what else is going on in the building.
Instead of the refrigerator or
at
6:30.
30, right.
6:30 to 8.
All are welcome.
Is that the 10-step process? Is that the...
You knew 10th, 1st, 2nd? No, it's the 12th. Yeah, it's actually a recovery cycle.
Yeah.
We're dealing with them.
Great. Thank you. So just as a poetic reminder of going through... the importance of going through, let's listen one more time to the well of grief. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning downward through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. Thank you for your practice, and may any good that came out of your attention and your intention tonight, may it be for the benefit of all beings.